that's going to embark on this adventure of listening to the teachings of the precious Gailan with Tenzin Rinpoche. So as I wanted to give kind of an introductory talk, kind of setting the stage, the background for the worldview that he's going to be speaking in. Then before we begin, let's spend a moment cultivating our motivation. So it's good to ask ourselves, what was our initial motivation for coming here? And just reflect on that a little bit. What kinds of thoughts and attitudes brought us to be here in this room today, embarking upon the teachings on the precious garland? And whatever our initial motivation was, let's amplify it and expand it. And remembering that our life has come about and is completely dependent upon the kindness of sentient beings, let's cultivate an attitude of gratitude and appreciation for other sentient beings. And when we train our mind in gratitude in that way, then the judgment falls away and we can see others as lovable, because their kindness to us remains very prominent in our mind. And then reflecting on our own misery and cyclic existence of birth, aging, sickness, death, and everything that happens in between, see that that's also the situation of all other sentient beings. And just as we want to be free and have lasting happiness, so do they. And so in order to bring about their happiness, we have to free ourselves from all of our own internal hindrances and obscurations and develop our own potential and capacity completely. And so it's for this reason that with a compassionate motivation, we generate the aspiration for full enlightenment in order to benefit all living beings. And so generate that aspiration. I thought before giving you the worldview that Tenzin Rinpoche is going to speak from, I'd talk a little bit about his life and Nagarjuna's life. So Tenzin Rinpoche was born around 1930, so he's 76 now. And he was born in the Pempo region of Tibet, which is outside of Lhasa. And that's actually the Pempo is where Lama Tsongkhapa wrote the Lamrim Chenmo, in that area of Tibet. And I'm not sure how old he was when he went to Sarah, but he trained in Sarah Monasteries, which was one of the three great large monasteries in Lhasa. And he trained there for a number of years until 1959, when there was the abortive uprising against the Chinese occupation, Chinese communist occupation. And then he wound up fleeing to India as a refugee. And my guess is, I'm pretty sure he was at Baksa, which was the old British POW camp that they used during World War II, which became the refugee camp for the Tibetans in 59 and 60. And then at some point he went down to South India. The Indian government was incredibly kind. I mean, India, in spite of being so poor, provided asylum for tens of thousands and now hundreds of thousands of Tibetans, and gave them land in various parts to erect their settlements. So Sarah was given some land in South India outside of Mysore, and the land had, as I heard it, lions and tigers and I don't know about bears, but ho ho. And so the monks had to clear the land and build the monasteries from the very beginning. And then it must have been in the late 70s, after Manjushri Institute was founded by Lama Yeshe as part of one of the early centers of the FPMT, then, because Lama was also from Sarajay, he asked Tenzin Rinpoche to go to Manjushri Institute to teach. And as I heard it, I didn't hear this directly from Tenzin Rinpoche, but I heard that he kind of said, well, why are you sending all the geshis to teach these people who don't know anything about Buddhism, who just need to learn, you know, like, don't kill and don't steal, you know, things like this. You know, why you said, because he's a Geshe-la Rampa, which is like the, you know, a PhD with honors, so it's, you know, a very high educational degree. It's just kind of, well, why, you know, why are you sending people like that to the West? Lama said, well, just wait, you'll see. And then as I heard the story, then a few years later, Kinsa Rinpoche said to Lama, I understand now, because, you know, we Westerners ask a lot of questions, and they're not necessarily the questions that the Tibetans would ask. You know, so you really need somebody who's quite astute and knows the teachings very well to be able to dialogue. You know, because we come from a completely different set of assumptions, you know. Speaking to a Tibetan audience, you don't need to talk about the existence of rebirth, the existence of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, or karma, nirvana. You know, these things are taken for granted. You know, Westerners go, well, what do you mean karma? What's that? You know? And Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, how do I know they exist? This is, you know, this sounds just like what I was taught as a little kid, believe in God. You know, how do I know there's such thing as Buddha, Dharma, Sangha? So, you know, it's not easy questions to ask. So you really need somebody who's quite astute to be able to handle students like us. So he taught at Manjushri Institute for a number of years. And then it was must have been in late 82 or early 83, then he came to be the abbot of Nalanda Monastery. That's in southern France. And I, at that time, was studying at, I was at Dorje Palmo, another, you know, monastery, the nun's complement of Nalanda. And we used to go over to Nalanda and have teachings together. So that's the period from 82 to 85 where I really studied quite extensively with Kenzo Rinpoche. And he taught with such incredible joyous effort. It was unbelievable because he would teach 2 hour-and-a-half classes 5 days a week to us, you know. And we were like, you know, and he was just rearing to go. And it was interesting because I knew Venerable Steve from that time too, so this is like, you know, 20, 25 years ago. And Venerable Steve and I, somehow we were thinking alike in those days and had the same questions, and Kenzo Rinpoche would say something and then his hand or my hand would go up. But, you know, you can, this, you know, always asking questions. So he was incredibly patient with us. So then he went back to Sera Monastery after about 10 years at Nalanda, and he's been teaching there for a number of years, and he became the abbot. He was the abbot for 6 years, and so that's why he has the title Kenzo Rinpoche. Kenzo means a former abbot, and Rinpoche means precious, so it's a title. That's not his name. Okay, so the precious former abbot of Sera J. And although I wasn't at Sera J at that time, I've heard from a number of people that he was a really excellent abbot and was able to bring about a lot of peace and harmony in the monastery. Because in those days there were some difficulties going on, so he was apparently quite skillful in dealing with people who had different ideas. And then in recent years he's been traveling a little bit more. He was in Taiwan last year, I think, or earlier this year. He's going to New Zealand after he's here. So really spreading the Dharma. And quite an exceptional teacher, so I really recommend that you take full advantage of studying with him and asking your questions. And Venerable Steve is also quite a good translator. He's been translating for Kenzo Rinpoche for many years, so really, you know, knows the language. Okay, and then we're going to be studying the precious garland of Nagarjuna. And Nagarjuna was one of the early Buddhist sages. The Buddha lived 5th century AD, and the Tibetans say that Nagarjuna appeared 400 years after that, which would be 1st century BC, and lived for 600 years. Okay, Western scholars say that Nagarjuna appeared late 1st century, early 2nd century AD, and that there were probably 2 or maybe even more Nagarjunas, one who taught sutra, one who taught tantra. Regardless, doesn't matter, you know, if you look at the meaning of the text is quite profound. But I thought I'd tell you a little bit about the stories in the scriptures involving Nagarjuna. You know, whether you take them literally or not is completely up to you. But I think that they have some kind of purpose behind them too. So it's said that Nagarjuna, before this lifetime, many eons ago, he was the disciple of another Buddha whose name I forget. I can get all these names for you if you're interested. But I'm very bad at names. And so he made a very strong determination and vow in the presence of that Buddha, because he had great compassion, great altruism, to really spread the Dharma and make the Dharma flourish. And so that Buddha at that time then predicted his enlightenment after so many eons, you know, being born in a certain pure land and becoming enlightened there. And as a result of that vow that he made in that previous life, then many eons later, he was born, you know, in India, you know, during the dispensation of Shakyamuni Buddha. And it's said that, you know, by those who believe that he lived 600 years, that Nagarjuna came three times on our earth. The first time he was born, and he became a monk under Saraha, and he was living at Nalanda, and he protected the monks there from famine by doing alchemy and different things. So he worked for the Sangha monastic community in that capacity at that time. Then he went to the land of the Nagas. The Nagas are these kind of creatures that are kind of like snakes, but not really. They're, you know, some of them live in wet or damp areas, and they're said to have great jewels and vast wealth. So he went to the land of the Nagas, and the reason he did this was that during the time of Shakyamuni Buddha, the Buddha taught the Prajnaparamita Sutras, and the content of those sutras was quite radical. It was really teaching about the emptiness of inherent existence of all phenomena. And it said that the people who were alive at the time of Shakyamuni Buddha didn't have the mental receptivity to that level of teachings. And so although the Buddha gave them, they were not widely spread, and the scriptures were taken to the land of the Nagas for protection. So then in Nagarjuna's second reappearing, you know, he went to the land of the Nagas, then when he came back to his second reappearance on earth, he brought back with him the Prajnaparamita Sutras and began to teach those. And those are some of the sutras that are in the conger over there. They're incredibly profound, and so much of our tradition is based on them, really presenting the view of reality. And so in this period of Nagarjuna's life, then he taught vastly about emptiness. And so, you know, many of the texts that he's wrote, including this one, I think came from that period in his life. And then he left the earth again, and he went, I forget where he went that time, but when he came back that time, he brought with him some more Mahayana sutras, like the Great Drum Sutra, the Great Cloud Sutra, and so on. So bringing even more Mahayana sutras to our earth. And then after he passed away from this life, then was born in, I think, that Pure Land, and, you know, has or will soon attain full enlightenment there. What I think is quite interesting about this story, again, whether you take it literally or not, is it places a person's existence over many lifetimes. And it really is an example to us of the power of cause and effect. Because in the previous life, you know, having out of, you know, this individual with such tremendous compassion for the rest of us, making this vow to spread the teachings, and especially the teachings on emptiness. And so due to the force of that mental state, that great vow, that great aspiration, then being born, you know, in the dispensation of Shakyamuni Buddha, and being able to teach emptiness and leave for us these amazing texts that teach the right view and the path to liberation and enlightenment. And then similarly, because of that vow, because of his magnificent altruistic deeds in this life, then being able to be born in the Pure Land and attain full enlightenment. So it's really, you know, showing the existence of a person over many, many lifetimes, and how what we do at one time of our existence influences what happens at another time of, in our existence. And I think this can act as a way for us to look at what we aspire to do. What are the aspirations that we put in our own mind stream? Nargarjuna, motivated by compassion, put the aspiration to benefit all beings by spreading the teachings of emptiness. What do we aspire for? You know, I aspire to get a good job so I can have a lot of money. I aspire to have a happy relationship and a happy family life. You know, look at the kinds of, you know, aspirations that come to our mind kind of quite naturally, and, you know, begin to question them. And say, you know, okay, we're all making aspirations all the time, but look at the aspirations I'm making, look at the aspirations Nargarjuna made. What are the results of my aspirations going to be? And what were the results of his aspirations? And then it kind of can inspire us to be a little bit more careful about what we aspire for, because we're planting those seeds in our mind. An aspiration, you know, is directing our mind in a certain way. So we have to really take care, you know. Sometimes we might aspire, oh, may I get even with that person who harmed me. Now, well, what does that do to our mind when we put that kind of aspirational energy into it? And what kind of result is that going to bring to us in terms of where we'll be reborn and what we'll be able to do in our future lives. So that's what I find useful about these kinds of stories. You know, I used to kind of rebel against them, and oh, this sounds like fairy tales. They really expect us to believe Nargarjuna will live 600 years. Oh, yeah. You know, it's like, okay, you know, let's leave that aside and let's look more at the point behind it. And when you look more for the point behind it, there's some Dharma meaning in there that can really teach us something important. Okay, so that's a little bit about Nagarjuna. And then the Precious Garland, there's kind of two main themes in the teaching from the Precious Garland, which is I don't know if Nagarjuna wrote it or spoke it, but it was a precious garland of advice directed for a king, you know, so he's giving advice to this king about how to practice. So the two main themes are what we call, Geoffrey Hawkins in his translation translates it as a high status. I prefer the translation of fortunate state. Yeah, because high status, you know, we're so status conscious in this country. We think of high status as, you know, being the president or being a CEO, and that's not what's meant by high status. It's a fortunate state, okay, which I'll explain what that means in a minute. And the other theme is what's called definite goodness, and that refers to liberation and enlightenment. So here we're talking about you know, how to make our life useful. Yeah, the things that we can direct our minds towards in the future by taking advantage of the potential we have now with our precious human life. So, fortunate state refers to a good rebirth, And actually more specifically, any kind of happy feeling in the mind or virtuous state of mind that appears in those with human rebirth or deva rebirth, God rebirth. And so that is the happiness within cyclic existence. So it's limited happiness, but it's a fortunate state, and that's the kind of state that we have right now. Okay. And then the other purpose of our precious human life, the other theme of the precious garland, is definite goodness, which refers to liberation, which is getting free of the cycle of constantly recurring problems or samsara, and enlightenment, which is attaining full Buddhahood, so not only freeing ourselves from this vicious cycle, but gaining all the qualities necessary to really be able to lead others on the path to enlightenment as well. Okay, so those are the two major themes. Now, in order to understand those themes, we have to back up a little bit, okay? And what does it mean to be in cyclic existence? What is this cyclic existence that we want to attain a higher state in? Okay, and what is this cycle of existence that we, you know, actually want to be free of and free others from? Okay. Now, to understand cyclic existence, we have to back up even a little bit more. Okay, to what does it mean to be a person? Okay, what is a person? What we label I, or what we label as a person, is dependent on the body and the mind. Okay? So let's just relate this to our experience. You know, we have a certain name because there's a body and there's a mind here. And rather than say, that body over there with those gray hairs and those wrinkles and, you know, that mind that, you know, has a habit of getting angry is walking down the street, you know, it's kind of a shortcut to say Sam or Harry or Susan or, you know, Patricia or, you know, whoever, you know, is walking down the street. Okay, so a person is something that is merely labeled in dependence upon a body and a mind. Okay, so let's look at what the body and the mind are. Okay, body, you know, our society knows lots about bodies. Okay, yes, or at least we think we do, and we're spending many dollars in research trying to learn more about the body. Okay, but one thing we know is the body is made of atoms and molecules. It's material in nature, isn't it? It has color and shape and smell, and it makes sounds, and it, you know, touches and all these kinds of things. We know a lot about the brain. The brain is a physical organ, you know, again, color, shape, made of atoms and molecules. Okay, so that's the nature of the body, yeah? And the body has its causes, okay? The substantial causes of our body, the things that were like the principal things that became our body, are the sperm and egg of our parents. So actually, our body isn't even ours. It's actually our parents, isn't it? Okay? If you think about it, it's not ours. It's the sperm and egg of our parents. Okay? But it's not just the sperm and egg of our parents. It's all the broccoli and tofu and, you know, everything else you've eaten since you were born. So that's what this body is. It's just a combination of, you know, all the various elements on the table of elements that we study in chemistry class. Okay? That's all it is. Yeah? So that, the sperm and the egg and all the food we ate before, that's the cause of the body. Yeah, the body is alive now. We say it's alive, or we say we're alive, because the mind and the body are interrelated. They have some connection. When the mind and the body split, then the body becomes a corpse, and it gets recycled. Doesn't it? You know, this body that we cherish so much, that we pamper so much, that we worry about so much, that we spend so much money to make it beautiful and comfortable basically just gets recycled. Yeah? And it came from recycled material. Didn't it? It came from the body of our parents, which is, you know, recycled broccoli and potatoes and everything too. Yeah? And, you know, it's funny, we laugh at it, but this is really, it's true, isn't it? This is all the body is. So it makes us wonder why we're so attached to it. Yeah? I mean, if there were kind of this pile of you know, just groceries there, would you be so attached to it? Oh, my body, you've got to be comfortable. But that, you know, really, that's just the nature of the body and, you know, what the cause of the body is, what the result of the body is. Okay, the mind is not made of atoms and molecules. It's not made of the things on the periodic chart. Yeah? The mind has two qualities. One is clarity and the other is awareness. Clarity means the ability to reflect objects. And awareness means the ability to engage with those objects. So when we say mind, we're talking about all the parts of us that are conscious, okay, that reflect and engage objects. So it includes our emotions, our intellect, our sense consciousnesses, you know, the visual consciousness that sees color and shape, the auditory consciousness that hears sound, the olfactory consciousness that detects odors, the gustatory consciousness that tastes, the tactile consciousness that feels various sensations, and the mental consciousness, which, among other things, thinks and does other various activities. Okay, it sleeps and everything else. Okay, so we have those six basic consciousnesses, five sense consciousnesses, and the mental consciousness. And then we have all these mental factors, which could be feelings of happiness or unhappiness or neutral. They could be discriminations, and they could be all the kinds of emotions that we have, all the various attitudes and views that we have. So any kind of conscious, aware element of us, it's all heaped under this big grab bag that we call mind. Okay? So don't think of mind and brain as the same thing. They aren't. Yeah, the brain is a physical organ. The mind isn't. When I have an Encarta encyclopedia on my computer, and one day I looked up brain, pages upon pages upon pages about brain. Then I looked up mind. Just very short entry, you know. If you ask a scientist, what is the mind? They usually change the subject. Because scientists don't really know what the mind is. You know, some of them say, oh, the mind is just an emergent property of the brain. Yeah. When the brain, you know, your serotonin does this and that, and your synapses fire in a certain way, then there's mind. But I don't find that very satisfactory. Yeah. Because, and I asked one of the scientists once, I said, when you're upset with somebody, do you think it's only my synapses that are firing in this certain way that's making me upset? He said, no. You know? And it's true. I mean, when we're upset, or when we're feeling a lot of gratitude or kindness or appreciation towards others, that is an internal experiential feeling, isn't it? It's not just nerves and chemicals. Because you could have those nerves and chemicals flashing in your Petri dish. And are you going to say, oh, there's attachment or there's love? No. You know, because those are things that are experiences that are there in our mind. And they aren't made of atoms and molecules. You know, the mind and body have some relationship while we're alive, don't they? You know, because you can see if... you know, it goes both ways. If you're sick, then you get in a bad mood easier. Okay? But also, if you're in a bad mood, you get sick easier. Yeah. If you're in a good mood and you have a happy mind, you heal better. Yeah. So, you know, the body and mind are related, but they're not exactly the same thing. Yeah. I mean, when we feel pain or pleasure, for example, those are real feelings that we have ourselves. Yeah. They aren't just synapses and chemicals going on. Yeah, you wouldn't look in a dish and say, oh, there's synapse, there's pain, there's pleasure. Okay? The same thing, you know, I think when people see dead bodies, our culture tends to hide them away, you know. But when you see a dead body, something's different than a live body. Yeah, what is it? What's not there when there's a corpse? Yeah, the brain's still there, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the mind is gone. Okay? So while the body, you know, is physical in nature and its continuity is physical, you know, came from the sperm and egg, it gets recycled in nature, you know, 100% recycled material. Yeah? Then the mind, the clarity and awareness, it isn't physical like that. Yeah, so it has its own continuity. If we take our mind, like right now, right in this minute, okay, what is a substantial cause? Where did this moment of mind come from? Okay, did it just appear out of nowhere? No, it came from our previous moment of mind, didn't it? Okay, and that came from the moment of mind before that. And the moment of mind before that. So we have this incredible continuity of moments of mind that just go back. Yeah. And each of these moments of mind is different. Yeah. Hold the questions right now. Is our mind exactly the same right now as it was when we came in this room? No. We're thinking differently. Something's different. Yeah. What about your mind now and when you were 5 years old? Big difference. Okay. But there's a continuity there, isn't there? There's a continuity between the 5-year-old mind and the mind that we have now. When we were in our mother's womb, yeah, there was consciousness then. We don't remember it. Yeah. But we know that babies have consciousness. Or even, you know, when you're 1 month old, we don't remember that. Babies have consciousness. We know that. Okay? That consciousness, that mind in the newborn baby, or the mind of the fetus in the womb, it also had consciousness. It's also in the same continuity as our present mind stream. Okay? So we see that one moment of mind is produced by the previous. One moment of clarity and awareness is produced by the previous moment. And that by the previous and previous and previous. Then you get back to the time of conception, or whenever exactly it is that the consciousness, you know, enters into the sperm and the egg. Okay? So that consciousness, that mind at the moment of conception, where did it come from? What was its substantial cause? Okay. Did the stork bring it? Yeah, I don't think so. Yeah, did it just appear because of chemical firings in the brain? No. You know, up until that point, each moment of mind had come about due to the previous moment of mind. And so too, at that first moment of consciousness in this present life, you know, it came about due to a previous moment of mind, okay? So the mind before it entered into this body, okay? So there we get into the whole topic of previous lives, because that consciousness had previous moments in its continuity and so on, okay? So we can go back infinitely in terms of the mind. Yeah, one moment of mind being produced by the previous moment. And right now, our mind is conjoined with this body at the time we die, and death is simply the separation of body and mind. That's all death is. Just body going one direction, mind going in another direction. at the moment of death, the mind doesn't stop, okay, because you have one moment of clarity and awareness producing the next, and so the mind goes on after the death of this body into another life, okay? Some people say, well, where did it start? Yeah. And when they say that, I usually say, where did the number line start? Okay. Where does the number line end? Where does the square root of 2 end? Okay. So we get into topics here called infinity. You know, there isn't any beginning. Now, sometimes our mind feels much more secure if there's a beginning. I want a nice, clean, clear beginning. Yeah? Yeah. But things aren't like that, because if the beginning, let's say there were a beginning to mind, okay? So here, you know, you have something over here that's nothingness, and here's the beginning of mind, and then after this, then you have the continuity of mind. So there was some first moment of mind, okay? So if you state that there's some absolute first moment of mind, then the question comes, well, what caused it? Okay? Because if there were no cause, then it meant it came about causelessly. It came about with no causes. Does anything that exists and functions happen without causes? No, everything has to have a cause. Yeah. So if that first moment of mind had a cause, then that wasn't an absolute beginning to mind, was it? There was a cause to it. Okay? So Buddhism talks very much about infinity here, you know? We don't get into identifying a first moment of the universe or first moment of mind or anything like that, okay? Because logically, you know, when you apply reasoning, it's very difficult to identify any kind of absolute beginning like that, yeah? And this is regardless of whether it makes us more secure to believe in it or not. The reality is, you know, we can't identify something like that. Okay? The Buddha was very practical also in this way. You know, because sometimes people would come and ask him, well, you know, when was the beginning of the universe and when's the end of the universe and all this kind of, you know, metaphysical stuff. And he didn't answer those questions. He was very practical. And he said, if you got shot by an arrow, okay, you're shot by an arrow, the wound's gushing blood, but before you went and to the doctor, you said, I want to know who made the arrow. Yeah, and where the arrow came from, and how many feathers it had, and who shot it, and why they shot. You know, if you wanted to know all that before you got your medical treatment, forget it. You know, you're going to die. So similarly, he said, you know, here we are in a situation of confusion, of misery in our lives. If we spend all of our time trying to theorize about the beginning of the universe and the beginning of the mind, you know, what's the purpose? We're just going to keep perpetuating our own misery. You know, instead, what's important is for us to examine what really is the cause of our unhappiness. What really causes unhappiness? Okay? Now, we usually, when we think of what causes unhappiness, especially in our Western culture, we come up with a whole litany. You know, it starts with our parents, doesn't it? Ever since Freud, we blame everything on our parents, which I think is a gross injustice, you know. Why am I so screwed up? Well, because my parents, you know, got married too young and they fought and they, you know, I was the third child and they didn't like me, you know. Okay, so well, that's the reason of my problem. Or another reason, well, my teachers, you know, oh, my first grade teacher didn't understand me and my third grade teacher, you know, made me do what I didn't want. Okay, that's the cause of our problem. What else is the cause of our problems? The government, you know, George Bush, you know, cause of all problems. So, you know, and then on a more personal level, what are other causes of our problems? Well, our teachers, our bosses, our partners, our friends, our neighbors. You know, we're always blaming something outside. Why am I unhappy? Because somebody else did this. Okay? So that's our usual view about the cause of our misery. That worldview is a dead end. Because in order to get happiness, if you have that worldview that you're happy, that happiness and suffering comes from outside, then the only way to be happy is to get rid of everybody who bugs you. Okay? And get rid of all the situations that you don't like. And surround yourself by everything that you like and everyone that you like. Okay? And that's the way we've been trying to do it and arrive at happiness since we've been born, haven't we? Always trying to put near us everything that we like, everyone that we like, and to get rid of, get away from, destroy everything we don't like. Have we succeeded? No. Okay? So that's what I mean. Like, that worldview is a total dead end. Do you know anybody who succeeded? Anybody who's 100% happy? Who has everything they want and nothing that they don't want? Do you know anybody? Can you name one person? You know, you're going to say Princess Diana. Do you think Princess Diana was happy? I don't think so. I wouldn't want to be like Princess Diana. Do you think Bill Gates is happy? He can't even walk down the street. Yeah, when you're rich like that, you can't even do a simple thing like walk down the street. Yeah, his kids can't even, you know, go out and play. Yeah, imprisoned by wealth. Okay? So, I mean, look, and who do we know who's everlastingly happy by successfully rearranging everything in their life? It doesn't work. And anyway, even we, you know, we've all done this, haven't we? We get everybody around us that we like, and then what happens? We don't like them anymore. And they don't like us. And this person that we thought was the most wonderful person who's going to make me always happy, you know, then they bug us, you know, and they get on our nerves and we want to be free from them. Okay? Our minds are incredibly unstable, aren't they? You know, and what makes us happy or unhappy at any minute is so changeable. So changeable. One minute we want this, next minute we want that. Okay? So we can see that this whole worldview of happiness and suffering come from outside, therefore I have to rearrange my environment. It just doesn't work. Okay? What the Buddha did is he said, check up if that worldview is actually correct or not. Okay? And then he gave us some methods to check up. And he said, look at the state of your mind and how does your mind create your happiness or your suffering? Okay? So the example that I find is so stark here is waking up in a bad mood. Okay? We've all woken up in a bad mood. Okay? When I wake up in a bad mood, I have what I call free-floating anger. And it means I'm in a bad mood, nothing happened, I don't know why I'm in a bad mood, but I'm waiting for somebody to say good morning so I can get mad at them. Okay? Because then I can blame my bad mood on somebody else. They said good morning in a way I didn't like. Okay? And, you know, it becomes so obvious that when we're in a bad mood, nothing ever makes us happy. Okay? You know, we can be in the most beautiful place, but if we're in a bad mood, we are so miserable. Yeah, we can be with somebody that we're very fond of. If we're in a bad mood, we can't stand them. We could be wanting some kind of acknowledgement or prestige or something. We can get it, but if we're in a bad mood, we don't enjoy it. Okay? So what we're getting at here is the state of our mind creates our happiness and suffering. Similarly, if we're in a good mood, even if somebody criticizes us, we're okay with it. We don't get bent out of shape. Even if we're in a good mood, even, you know, they don't serve what we like for lunch, we're okay. We don't complain. So much comes from our own mind. And in addition, you know, okay, we might, even if we're not in a bad mood, let's say somebody says something to us, and we interpret it as criticism. Oh, that person's criticizing me. They're making me unhappy. They're the source of my suffering. Therefore, I have to retaliate and I have to say something to defend myself because they are accusing me unjustly. Because whenever people give us feedback we don't like, it's always unfair, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the primary assumption through the universe. You know? How dare you give me negative feedback? I didn't do it. I mean, we learned that from the time we were kids, didn't we? Yeah. It's unfair. It's his fault, not mine. You know, even though we did whatever obnoxious thing we did as kids, we always say, you know, it's not my fault. Somebody else's fault. Okay? So, you know, we get defensive when somebody gives us feedback we don't like. Even they're trying to help us. Even somebody says, please clean the spoon. We go, you tell me what to do. You know, why are you telling me to clean the spoon? Who do you think you are? You know, I mean, just watch, we watch our minds, don't we? You know, somebody, we sign up on the chore list in there. Oh, why do I have to sign up on that chore? Oh, why do I have to put the dishes away in this certain room? You know, so our mind always having so many opinions, so many judgments about everything. And when we, you know, have these kinds of opinions and judgments, these kind of interpretations on our experiences, then we get in a, you know, we become resentful, we become belligerent and angry and upset and unhappy. Okay? And it's all coming from our own mind. And this is, you know, one of the things that you really see when you live together in community. This is part of the purpose of the Abbey, is we live together and we just watch how our minds write these incredible stories and either get ecstatic or upset, and it has nothing to do with the other person at all. Yeah, it's our own trip. And because even if somebody says to us, you know, you were supposed to do this and you didn't do it, and we get upset, why do we need to get upset? This is the thing I go through when I get angry, you know? I'm angry. And then I say, why am I angry? And my mind says, well, because he did this and she did that. And then I go, oh, yeah, sure, they did those things, but why are you angry? I ask myself. Well, they did this and this. That's true, they did that, but why are you angry? Why does somebody doing that have to produce the result of me being angry? Where's that anger coming from? Not coming from the other person. I have a choice whether to be angry or not, you know. And I usually really get into the anger, you know. But then I get miserable afterwards, okay? So we really begin to see how our happiness and our suffering comes from the state of our own mind. Yeah, our mind creates our happiness and suffering. So it creates the happiness and suffering in two ways. One way is by what we're thinking now, how we are interpreting an event right now. We make ourselves happy or miserable. Another way is through whatever motivations, okay, that we have now. Those motivations, those thoughts or emotions generate certain actions. Those actions, you know, those actions are karma. That's what karma is. It's just action, okay, of our body, of our speech, of our mind. These mental, physical, verbal actions leave traces of energy on the continuum of our mind. Those are called karmic seeds or karmic imprints, okay? So they're like predispositions or tendencies to have various experiences. So that's another way that our mind causes our experience, is through the karma that we create. Through the actions we do, we put seeds in our own mind that influence what we experience. Okay? Have you ever wondered, why was I born me? You ever wondered that? Yeah? You know, why was I born in this particular family? Why was I born in this country? Why did I have the opportunities that I had in my life? Why didn't I have other opportunities in my life? Why? You know? I mean, we could have been born as a totally different person. Different body, different family, different schooling, everything. You know, why were we born in this body? with this set of circumstances. From a Buddhist viewpoint, we attribute that to karma, to the actions that we did in previous lives. So in this present life, we're experiencing the result of a tremendous amount of good karma. We have human bodies, we have a human mind, so we can think, we can hear teachings, we have some discriminating wisdom that can tell the difference between what is helpful to practice and what we need to abandon, between what are the causes of happiness, what are the causes of misery. So just having this human body and mind is the result of incredible good karma that we've created from the past. Having food that we've eaten, that we take for granted, didn't come just by accident. We created the karma through being generous in previous lives to have food now. We created the cause for a human body and mind by keeping ethical conduct in the past. Okay? If we have a reasonable appearance and we're not tremendously ugly, it's because of having kept patience in the past, okay, and refrained from anger. So many of the situations and conditions that we have right now, they don't come out of nowhere. You know, they come out of our past actions. And if we actually look at our life, we have a tremendous amount of freedom and good fortune. So this didn't happen by chance. And it's not freedom and good fortune just in terms of being able to have pleasure, okay? Because we can experience a lot of pleasure, but then where does it go after it's experienced? I remember before I got ordained, I went back and I destroyed a bunch of stuff at my parents' house. And I went back, scrapbooks, you know, I had this whole scrapbook with souvenirs from all the guys I had dated as a teenager. You know, huge scrap, you know, napkins, and, you know, okay? So you look at it, you know, that's rubbish as a teenager. But as adults, we collect a lot of our own adult rubbish, don't we? And even if it's not physical stuff, we store up a lot of memories, okay? But the memories of previous happiness are just memories, aren't they? You know, that happiness is not happening now. So especially if we had to hurt somebody else, we hurt somebody else or we acted in a very selfish way in order to get some kind of happiness, you know, earlier on, the happiness we experienced and it's gone, but the karmic imprints from doing those actions that brought about, that made us get what we wanted, those karmic imprints are still in our mind stream and they're going to influence what happens to us, okay? Whenever we have some kind of misery in our lives, we always go, why me? We never do that when we have happiness. Yeah, after breakfast this morning, none of us went, why me? Why did I have the good fortune of having breakfast this morning when so many people are starving? None of us ever. You know, did you think that this morning? You know, we just spaced out. We take it for granted. Okay, but it didn't happen by accident, you know, and it's incredible good fortune that we have. But the moment some small harmful thing happens, yeah, we stub our toe, why me? Okay, so every, you know, any negative thing, why me? How come I have this suffering? Nobody else does. And then we get into a big pity party. Okay, poor me, poor me, you know, and we really get into it, which of course makes the situation worse, yeah, but we get a certain kind of ego pleasure from feeling sorry for ourselves, don't we? So, you know, we begin to see that when we have happiness in our lives, it's not coming out of nowhere. It's due to our previous actions, which depended on the mind that motivated them. And when we are suffering now, it depends on our previous karma that depended also on the minds that did those actions that, you know, planted those karmic seeds that ripened in the misery that we're experiencing. And then we also begin to see that how we react to whatever happiness or misery we have now, okay, either increases that happiness and misery or decreases it. Okay, that we have, you know, even though karma's ripening from the past, how we react to our situations now creates our happiness and suffering now, and it also creates more karma for the future. Okay? So let's say I want something really bad and I don't get what I want. Okay? And then I get angry and resentful because the world's always unfair to me and everybody else has good things but not me. You know, and I get stuck in my anger and my resentment, or maybe my jealousy, oh, they always get it and I never do. Okay? Then those emotions make us miserable right now. And because, you know, they lead us to, let's say, plotting revenge or throwing a pity party or moaning and groaning and wasting, you know, our life, then those same mental states just lead us to create more and more negative karma, which creates more and more suffering in the future. Okay? Whereas if we have a ripening of negative karma, we're unhappy right now, but we say, oh, this is a ripening of negative karma. That's good that that karma from the past ripened. Now it's finishing. Okay, it's over and done with. It could have resulted in many eons in an unhappy, miserable rebirth, but it didn't. Yeah, so I have a headache right now. Well, that's quite manageable. Okay, because a lot of our misery, oh, this is unbearable. But when you think about, well, it could have ripened in a horrible rebirth, then, well, this misery is quite bearable, actually. You know, I can make it through this one. Okay, if we think like that, then our mind becomes happy now, and we don't get involved in more negative karma. Yeah, by moaning and groaning and being bitter and, you know, unhappy. Yeah. Instead, we're able to switch our mind so the mind is happy now, and then we'll engage in more actions. For example, even though we may experience some suffering, we become much more compassionate and much more helpful to other people because we understand what their situation is better is in a much better way. And so that compassionate attitude and the actions that flow from it create more good karma. Okay? So we might experience the ripening of a negative karma, and from that we can either create more negative karma or we could create positive karma. In a similar way, we can experience the ripening of positive karma and totally space out, you know, like we did about breakfast. Yeah, especially if we just look at breakfast and, oh, there's good food, I like that, you know. And sometimes we're like that around food. We're kind of like, you know, animals. Yeah, you know how dogs and cats just, you know. And you see this, like sometimes I love to watch it, you know, in cafeterias. Yeah, people started eating the food before they've even paid for it. You know, it's just the mind is like, you know, totally fixated, okay? So there's a ripening of good karma. Yeah. But maybe, you know, that person is taking what hasn't been freely given to them by taking the food, or maybe they're having a very greedy mind while they're eating, or maybe they're feeling arrogant. Oh, I have all this good food. What about those poor slobs on the earth who don't have, you know? So, you know, the reaction to our good karma could be very, you know, very varied, okay? So if we react with some kind of self-centered motivation, then that could very easily lead us to, you know, being more, having more deception or stealing or cheating in some way, you know, to get more things that we want. Or, you know, if we have a ripening of good karma, we could respond with, you know, and this is why we do the prayers before we eat. But, you know, here's the food and we offer it to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, or we offer it to sentient beings so they can make offerings to Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. We eat with mindfulness, you know, and a feeling of appreciation for all of those who gave us the food. Yeah, and so from that creates a lot of good karma, which leads to happiness in the future. Okay? So we can see that what we experience now is a result of the past, but what we experience now also leads us to create the causes for what we'll experience in the future. And so that's why it becomes so important to pay attention to what's going on in our mind. Okay? Because at the moment of death, Yeah, what's going on in the mind is going to determine where we're reborn. So if we die and at the time of death we're very angry, let's say, why do I have to die? This is unfair. Medical science should have devised a way to cure me. You know, I should be able to live long, or I'm so miserable. Why do I have to suffer like this? And having a lot of anger. Then that anger creates, it kind of, it's like the fertilizer that makes some negative karma that we've created previously ripen. And when that negative karma ripens, then it distorts the way our mind perceives things. And all of a sudden, you know, wow, being born as an animal looks good. And before you know it, like that, you know, we're in the body of a donkey. Mm. Yeah? Or we're in the body of a grasshopper. Or something like this. Yeah? And so there's these different realms of existence. Yeah, the animal realm we can see. But there's other realms of existence. There's hellish beings, as hungry ghosts who are always dissatisfied. And those come about by the power of our mind and what our mind is familiar with. So if we have a mind that's always craving, 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 you know, and always dissatisfied, well, that's kind of like the mind of a hungry ghost. And, you know, we get reborn like that. If we spend a lot of our life creating fear in others and having a lot of malicious thought and ill will towards others, you know, we create the cause for a hellish existence in our own mind by the power of what our mind is thinking about, okay? In a similar way, at the time of death, if, let's say, we take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, or let's say we generate love and compassion, yeah, then that sets the stage for a constructive karma to ripen. Okay, so maybe the karma from making offerings to the three jewels, or maybe the karma of being kind and serving others, or maybe the karma of really helping others, taking care of others, then that karma ripens, and that makes our mind attracted to a good rebirth, you know, as a human or in a celestial realm, or as a deva or a god. Okay? So none of these realms where we get reborn in are permanent. They're not permanent lives, just as this life we have right now is not permanent, doesn't last forever. So as long as the karma or the causal energy is there to live in that, in any particular body, then our consciousness is conjoined with that body. When that karma runs out, then the body and mind separate and the mind goes on. Okay? Now we get reborn again and again because we're under the influence of ignorance. Okay, we misapprehend what the deeper nature of how we and everything else exists. Okay, so that ignorant mind, you know, lies at the foundation of our constant rebirth in the cycle of the cycle of existence or samsara. Okay, so initially in our practice, yeah, what we're trying to do is get a good rebirth, because that's kind of the most urgent thing. Okay, it's like, let's just at least in the next life stay out of the really bad rebirth. Okay, so that's why this thing, the aspiration for higher status or fortunate states, comes first. It's the most urgent thing. But then, as our mind expands, we want to look beyond that, and we see that, okay, even if you get a good rebirth next time, still we're born under the influence of ignorance and clinging attachment and anger. Okay? And so we still have no freedom. The mind's controlled by these three poisonous attitudes. And so at that point we say, well, wait a minute, you know, what causes these three poisonous attitudes? And is there an antidote to them? And we see, you know, how they're rooted in ignorance, how wisdom is an antidote to ignorance. And then we generate the aspiration to be free of a cyclic existence and attain nirvana or liberation. Okay? So that's the beginning of definite goodness, the second theme in the text. Okay? And then as our mind expands further and further, you know, it began by thinking about, let's get myself out of cyclic existence. As our mind expands, then we think, well, what about everybody else? they're all exactly like me, wanting happiness, not wanting to suffer. How about helping everybody to get out of cyclic existence? And when we do that, that leads to generating the bodhicitta, that altruistic intention, to become a fully enlightened Buddha in order to benefit all beings. And that's the second aspect of definite goodness. Okay? So that's a little bit of an introduction. I speeded it up at the end because we have to stay on schedule, but there's tomorrow, you know, if we're alive, then we can continue on then and go into the subject a little more. Maybe we have time just for a couple of questions. I want to try and stay to our schedule here. Yeah.
From the Buddhist perspective, is the mind in the heart? I think I've heard that.
Mm. Is the mind in the heart? Well, that being the heart, the one that pumps?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Or the etheric heart.
Yeah. You know, or some people think the mind is in the brain.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, the mind permeates the entire body. Mm. Yeah. When the time of death comes, the mind absorbs as it loses as the body is not able to support the consciousness anymore, then the mind kind of absorbs and dissolves into the center of the heart, in the center of our chest, and it's from there that it departs to the next life.
This way or this way?
Well, it depends. It depends.
Where are you going?
Yep. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
Puzzled me all my life is if there is a continuation, how come there's not a steady state of human souls that we keep expanding? We're populating the earth with human souls, and I'm not even sure there's enough, you know, other sentient beings to be able to balance this all out. Are there other realms that you're thinking about?
Okay, so your question is, how come the human population on Earth is expanding?
Yes.
You know, because there's a whole big universe where you can be reborn. And there's many realms of existence. Yeah. And human beings are actually quite a minority on this planet. You know, we're a little bit arrogant, you know, thinking we control the planet, because actually we're a minority. There's many more animals and insects. Aren't there? Yeah. And then in addition to this, there's many places in this universe to be born, many places in other universes. Planet Earth is very tiny, actually. Yeah.
Does one moment build on the previous moment? And the reason I ask that is because as we get older, we seem to get so much smarter.
Okay, so just one moment, build on the previous moment, because as we get older we get smarter, contrary to what we thought when we were teenagers. Yeah, we thought that we knew everything then and the adults were dumber. One moment does build on the next, but whether we get smarter depends on us, okay? Because some people, you can see in their lives, they make the same mistake again and again. They don't seem to learn from their mistake. Okay? Whereas if we can really make peace with our past and learn from our mistakes, then, you know, one moment builds on another in a very wonderful way. Yeah?
If the two qualities of the mind are clarity and awareness, why is there a lack of continuity in what we can remember? Like when the mind separates from the body at death, why is there no breaking point?
Okay, so why can't we remember previous lives? Or why can't we remember where we put our car keys a half an hour ago? Yeah, why is there that break in awareness? Okay, well, the mind is just aware of other things. Yeah, or sometimes it might be aware of just kind of, you know, a clear state. Something like that. And so we can't remember, you know, the mind is always aware of something, but it could be distracted by something else. And also our mind is very, very obscured. you know, it's tremendously obscured. We learn things, and we notice this a lot as we age, don't we? Yeah, you hear something, and 5 minutes later, it's gone. Okay? Yeah? And so, the mind is obscured. Or even we learn something when we're young, we can't understand it. You know, the mind's obscured. And so it's obscured by these afflicted mental states, what's sometimes called delusions or afflictions or disturbing attitudes and negative emotions. And it's also obscured by a lot of the karma that we've created in the past. Okay, so the mind has the opportunity, the ability to reflect things, but it's obscured, so it can't. Let's just sit quietly for a couple of minutes and digest what we heard and think about how to apply it in our life.